BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, you're listening to Inside Health, which was first broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on July the 7th, 2020. I'm James Gallagher, the BBC's health and science correspondent. The last time I was sat in front of this microphone was February. Since then, I've done little else apart from covering the pandemic. And sorry to disappoint, but this programme will be no different. But instead of looking at the coronavirus itself, we'll be assessing the impact on the rest of healthcare, particularly cancer. People have missed out on screening and testing, surgeries have been cancelled, treatments changed at the last minute, and clinical trials halted. Be in no doubt, this is going to lead to more people dying from cancer. How many will depend on how quickly the NHS can get back to normal. In the last series, we regularly visited Southampton General Hospital to see how they were coping. So what's happened to their cancer services? Dr. Trevor Smith is Divisional Director for Medicine. Now, sorry if the audio quality is a bit ropey as COVID stopped us doing the interview in person, but I asked him for an update.
In March and April, when we were at the peak of COVID cases, we saw a massive fall off in the number of people presenting themselves to hospital. So my colleagues have done some work in the lab, in the pathology lab, just looking at the number of cancer diagnoses that they've made on tissue samples in the lab. And there was a 50% reduction in the number of cancer diagnoses they made in that period between March and April.
So there is nothing to suspect the number of people who should be being diagnosed with cancer would have changed. So that's just half of people who have cancer not finding out.
Correct, yes.
Do we understand why? So is that people not going to their GP and then not ending up being referred to have the test at hospital? Or is it people going to their GP, being referred, but then going, I just don't feel comfortable going to hospital to be tested? I mean, why has the numbers fallen?
Yeah, so it's a mixture of all those things. So remember that 50% figure was March and April when we were at the kind of peak of the COVID storm, if you like. So things are recovering. But at that time, and the ongoing issues are that people weren't presenting themselves to GPs, so therefore the number of referrals were fewer. Where people were being referred in, there's been significant impact on the capacity of diagnostic facilities, so CT scanning, endoscopy facilities, because of the cautions around social distancing, because of some of the technical aspects of how we run endoscopy services, for example. So our capacity to provide the services have been severely limited. And thirdly, what we've also found is that a significant proportion of patients, and at one point it was 50% of patients where they were offered an appointment to come into hospital, chose to decline or delay that appointment for fear that they were putting their health at risk in terms of COVID risk by coming to hospital.
That is quite something, isn't it? To be told that you might have cancer, you need to have a test. You know, cancer, the C word, you know, it's been something that people have feared for decades.
Yes.
And then to not come into hospital. I mean, that tells you quite what the climate was like at the peak of COVID.
Yes. And the climate was one of fear. But we've got to get over that. And we've got to get the message out that we in Southampton and in every other hospital, there's a huge focus on making hospitals the safest places they can be. We have a big program of work and campaign in our hospital about being a COVID zero hospital. You come here, you'll be tested. All the staff are tested. Our systems and processes have been completely transformed with the primary aim of making sure that people can have the confidence to come to this hospital and other hospitals knowing that they can focus on their symptoms, making sure that they get that early diagnostic to either confirm or refute a cancer diagnosis and not allow that process to be delayed by fear of COVID.
More from Trevor later. And we're going to take a look at the national picture with Cancer Research UK in a moment. And I can tell you, some of the figures are staggering. But first, I want you to meet Charlie from Wiltshire. At the end of February, she found a lump in her breast. She went to her GP and was urgently referred to the breast cancer clinic.
I then had another lump appear under my arm. And by that point, about 3 or 4 days after I'd seen the GP, I was convinced it was cancer. But the doctor took a look and they said, right, we're going to do biopsies, mammograms. But we very much left that appointment and those tests clear in our minds that we were probably dealing with cancer at that point.
And then when you got the positive results back, how are you going to be treated?
I think it was around the 10th, 11th of March that I went back and got the confirmation of my results, breast cancer in both the lump within my breast and on my arm. So we knew it was cancer and we knew it had spread from breast to lymph node. at that point, there was discussions that the normal course of treatment would be chemotherapy first. However, obviously the COVID-19 situation was starting to become a bit more prominent. And there was discussions that my treatment might change due to this because of, obviously, chemotherapy. It suppresses your immune system. And they were unsure about whether, you know, to continue with chemotherapy if a pandemic was coming. So the discussion was, we would normally go down chemotherapy first with your situation of your lumps and your type of cancer. However, we might have to opt for surgery first, depending on how the situation changes. And that was kind of the discussion in early March.
How are you feeling about that at the time? Because I suppose coronavirus came on really quickly. It didn't come completely out of nowhere, but it you know, things changed very rapidly in the UK when, you know, cases really started to rise. And, you know, just the thought of that it was actually changing what type of treatment you'd need.
It's challenging. You know, I think you speak to anyone who gets a cancer diagnosis, it's challenging because I think we're still in a state where we think cancer and we equate it with death, unfortunately. So you're kind of suddenly, you know, facing your own mortality, and then thrown on top is this complete unknown situation that seems to be changing quite quickly. So to say it was overwhelming and emotional in those few days, I think still is a bit underestimating exactly how I was feeling. It's just, you're completely confused. You're trying to work out what's going on, let alone how it could change because of a situation like coronavirus.
The original plan was to use chemotherapy to shrink Charlie's tumour, and then surgeons would remove just the remaining lump. But cases of coronavirus exploding across the country led to a change of plan. Charlie was nervous about chemotherapy, which would weaken her immune system and could leave her more vulnerable to the virus. So instead of having just the lump taken out, she had a mastectomy to remove the whole breast.
COVID was a contributing factor to that decision. It wasn't the sole reason. However, there was more chance of getting a successful clear margins surgery with the location of the lump and the size of my breast through a mastectomy than there was lumpectomy. I actually went into surgery on the 23rd of March, which was right at the beginning of the UK's lockdown. And the mastectomy gave, I think, more options for less long-term complications when we were going into the pandemic. The lumpectomy could have led to more problems and need further surgery. It could have had more deformity. And we didn't know, the team didn't know, could we have surgery in 2 weeks' time, in 6 weeks' time? You know, would that be a possibility?
It feels so long ago, but you have to remember that that's when hospital operating theatres were being converted into like emergency COVID wards, because that's where the oxygen was to give to patients. I mean, the whole of the NHS was changing before your eyes. I mean, were you worried whether the surgery would go ahead?
Yes, very much so, because it was changing so much. And the hospital felt different when you went in. It had a different feel to it. You could tell everyone was kind of on a bit of a heightened sense of anxiety. But I was very lucky because actually I did get to go ahead and I did get to get surgery.
And on the day of the operation, were you allowed any family support? Was your partner there or was everyone at home?
No, this was one of the harder things, I think, because basically, you know, we had the children, but we had no one to look after the children. We've got no family close by because we're in a military community. So we obviously move around quite a lot. I was going to appointments on my own, and that included going into surgery on my own. And that was, that was challenging. But I think my army background makes me quite practical. And you kind of go, well, that's just the situation we're in. No, it's not ideal. Of course, I would love to have had my husband there and my mum at home looking after the kids. But, you know, this is just the situation we're in. I'm quite pragmatic in that sense.
You sound like you had the perfect mentality for dealing with all of this.
at times, I think, you know, we're all going to go into those deeper, darker moments. And don't get me wrong, there's times where the emotions took over and it was very difficult. But yeah, like I say, I try and be pragmatic and find a positive within any situation if I can.
I know it's still early days, but how are things looking at the moment?
We're in the middle of chemotherapy at the moment. And to be honest, in comparison, surgery was the easy part. Chemo is just this horrendous emotional roller coaster where your body and your brain are very much struggling. So I think this is the harder part of the journey for me, but I'm halfway through it, and three cycles down, three to go is a good place to be.
Have you ever wondered what it would have been like if coronavirus wasn't happening? Because you would have had a very different treatment from start to finish.
Yes, very different. It would have been chemotherapy first to shrink the tumour to try and then lessen the impact of what type of surgery you therefore have. And sometimes it can have such an impact that, you know, the surgery can be a lot less invasive. And also it can impact, therefore, what type of radiotherapy and how many sessions. So it kind of completely reversed what the normal, in inverted commas, procedure of treatment would be for my particular case, which I suppose you could keep looking back at and go, is there advantages, is there disadvantages? I don't know, because I just look at it and go, well, unfortunately, I was caught at the beginning of a pandemic with my cancer diagnosis. And yes, it changed my treatment, but it didn't stop it. And therefore, I focused down on that piece.
And best of luck as Charlie continues her treatment over the coming months. But now we go from Charlie to Charlie. That's Professor Charlie Swanton, the Chief Clinician at Cancer Research UK. He's also one of the world's leading cancer researchers, but throughout this pandemic, he's been spending more than half his time on coronavirus testing. So Charlie, how big has the impact on cancer care been in the UK?
We think that about 3 million people currently in the UK are awaiting cancer screening, cancer diagnosis or appropriate cancer treatment.
3 million?
3 million, that's right. That number is composed of about 2.7 million people who haven't been screened for the routine screening in the NHS. That's bowel screening, breast screening, mammography and cervical smear testing when they otherwise should have been, along with about 300,000 fewer people than normal who would be on the what we call the urgent suspected cancer referral pathway, resulting in about 33,000 fewer cancer treatments. Probably most profoundly in this is the fact that what we call the two-week waiting time numbers are down at peak to about 75% below what we would expect normally. So we would normally expect approximately 43,000 two-week wait referrals per week. During peak in April, that was down to only 11,000 referrals a week. So you can see that this has led to very significant disruption in the normal cancer referral treatment and screening pathways that we've come to expect.
We all know that you want to catch cancer earlier. That's when you have the best chance of treating it. But are there any particular types of cancer you're most worried about at the moment with these delays in diagnosis and getting people treated?
You're absolutely right. Early diagnosis is the key, without a shadow of a doubt. The standard cancers for which screening has been proven to be efficacious are cervical cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, but more recently also lung cancer screening to detect very early stage lung cancers before they spread. So really all four of those tumor types are absolutely central to get right in the context of screening, to diagnose those tumors earlier before they spread to either distant sites or have become locally advanced and inoperable.
And of course, it's not just that those patients aren't being spotted and referred to treatment. Some of the patients that are coming through the system aren't getting the treatments that they would normally get. We heard from Charlie, instead of having, you know, just the lump removed, she had a mastectomy. Her chemotherapy drugs were changed to minimise the risk because of coronavirus. I mean, we're a long way from normal, aren't we?
We are. I mean, I think central to this is to create COVID-protected cancer hubs. Now, they are being created as we speak. Some are up and running now to give patients the confidence they need to return to clinical care and to provide healthcare workers the confidence they need to be able to treat their patients safely.
So let's get to the point. We say we've got all these hubs established, but you know there's a big backlog of patients. Who do you choose who to prioritise? Who's the first patients you want to get in? Because it's going to be difficult decisions, aren't there?
Yeah, very difficult decisions. There is both a palliative need to alleviate symptoms and where possible to improve survival. And there's also a curative need for those that have early stage cancers, escalating and increasing surgical capacity so we can operate on patients' tumours whilst they're still operable to increase the chances of cure. It's a very delicate balance. Obviously, cure is the ultimate goal for our patients. But for those that we can't achieve cure in, where we can perhaps prolong survival but not cure, we equally have to make sure resources are allocated to those patients to alleviate symptoms and, where possible, improve survival outcomes too. It's a very, very difficult set of choices that will have to be made.
How worried are you about the next few years and a spike in deaths from cancer because of the, you know, the consequences of the NHS massively restructuring to tackle the pandemic?
I'm very worried. I think conservative estimates would put perhaps a total of 4,000 to 5,000 excess deaths as a result of missed opportunities to intervene in patients suffering from cancer in the UK because of the COVID crisis. My wider concern is quite how long this disruption is going to carry on for. My concerns are that there will be a second spike, perhaps a second wave, that may force local lockdowns, may further impact our ability to screen patients quickly enough, diagnose them early enough and treat them soon enough, that may lead to further disruption and very regrettably and very sadly, further deaths related to cancer.
And Charlie, what's it been like for you as someone who's dedicated a career to tackling cancer to watch one of the biggest disruptions ever to cancer services in this country?
It's incredibly depressing. The NHS and Cancer Research UK and cancer charities nationwide have worked very hard to get us to where we've got to. And even then, the best wasn't good enough. We still lag behind many of our European partner countries. Our survival rates aren't as good as they should be. And we've all been working hard to try to bring our survival rates to the top of the European league tables. COVID-19 pandemic has had a major impact on our ability to achieve that goal. And we're going to be set back by many years, undoubtedly, in our ability to be able to become the best in Europe in cancer outcomes, rather than just the middle or below average in our survival outcomes.
Professor Charlie Swanton there. We're focusing heavily on cancer in this programme because it's one of the biggest killers in this country. But nearly every aspect of NHS care has been affected by the pandemic. I remember doctors having to tell people to still come to hospital if they were showing signs of a heart attack or a stroke. Dr. Trevor Smith, who we heard from earlier, says those emergency cases are up to about 85% of normal at Southampton General Hospital, but some long-term conditions are still a problem.
I think probably the two headline areas are endoscopic services, endoscopy, our ability to provide diagnostic, surveillance and follow-up procedures, and also ophthalmology, so eye services. So we've seen rapid transformation in the way we deliver care for patients with long-term conditions, and much of that now is done remotely. But for ophthalmology services, and this is a challenge nationally, is that, you know, you have to see the patient, you have to examine the eye, you have to do eye tests and other diagnostic procedures. So because of the need to see patients that are generally more of an elderly population with higher clinical risks, then the backlog is more significant.
How worried are you about the non-COVID impacts of the pandemic?
We are worried, and we have been worried, and that's why we have essentially split the organisation of the hospital into two parts, or maybe three parts actually. One is around ongoing COVID planning and delivery. Secondly is a group that's purely focused on cancer. And thirdly is the group that's focused on the recovery of the rest of the hospital, the routine work that we do that we need to continue to do. So yes, it's been a significant concern to us really from day one.
If there was a second surge or a second wave, are you in a better position now than before?
Yes, absolutely. I think that there will be an increase in numbers again, whether it's a surge or a wave or a peak, let's hope there isn't. But we are absolutely prepared to switch on the COVID response that we've stepped down in recent weeks. So we know what we need to do.
Just looking at the whole of your hospital, how long do you think it will be, Trevor, until you can say we're back to normal? Is this months away, years, longer?
Look, I don't think we'll ever be back to normal. The overused phrase is the new normal, isn't it? I think that we will transition into something that is probably unrecognisable to the type of hospital that we left behind. But in terms of our capacity to do everything that we need to do, I think it will be at least a year.
And your hospital's piloting this saliva test, which is a fair bit easier than having to get a swab right down the back of your nose to get a sample. You just spit in a jar. How's that going?
The background is, to keep the hospital safe, we need to test everyone. But in terms of staff testing, it's quite a big deal for staff to be swab tested every week. You know, I've had this done, I have it done every week. You wouldn't choose to have it done unless you really needed to. And what we're talking about is having a testing program in place for many, many months ahead. So what we need to try and achieve is a secure system of the least invasive testing process possible. And that's where saliva testing comes in. So we don't know the full results yet, but we collected 2,000 samples. We had a massive response from our staff. The 2,000 samples were collected pretty much on day one of the pilot project. So that illustrates that our staff are motivated to do the right thing. They're motivated to support a program of work that will make life easier for them and easier for us.
I think it's a no-brainer. People are going to prefer a saliva test to a swab, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a no-brainer.
So now you've got saliva testing to add to swab testing and antigen testing and antibody testing. So let's take a moment before it all gets too confusing and have a quick refresher with Dr. Navjot Larda, a GP and head of education at the British Medical Journal. So first of all, what is an antigen?
So put really simply, an antigen is something that causes the body to trigger an immune response. And in the context of COVID-19, it's referring to the virus and specifically the surface of the virus that the body recognises as not belonging in the body, and it triggers an immune response. You can work out from there that an antigen test is really looking for the presence of the virus in your body. If you've got the virus in your body, you've got the infection. That's why it's the test of, have you got it now?
And as well as antigen tests, we'll have heard that called the swab test, yes, as well, and now maybe the saliva test if that works at, yeah, Southampton as well.
Yeah, so the swab test just refers to how the test is taken. It usually looks like a long cotton bud and it goes in your nose and in your throat. You might also hear it called the PCR test, which refers to how the test is analysed. Those words are usually used interchangeably, so the swab test, the PCR test, and yeah, perhaps seeing the saliva test as well.
If I can have my nerd alert points, polymerase chain reaction. There we go.
Yeah, score 10 nerd points. Yeah,
and the antibody test, how useful do you think they are? Because antibodies are only one part of your immune response. We're only really looking for one component of the immune response in order to determine whether people have had the virus and whether they're immune.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different aspects of how useful is the antibody test. So the antibody test is looking for the presence of antibodies, which tell you whether you've had the infection. And then what can you do with that information as well? So, yeah, so the first part is they're just looking at one aspect of the immune response. The second thing is the sort of reliability of the test. So how accurate is it when you get a result that's telling you that you've had a previous infection? And then also, perhaps most importantly, what can you do with that information? So at a population level, it might be useful to be able to know who's had the infection. So at the moment in the UK, the majority of antibody testing is happening in NHS workers and people who work in care homes to try and build a picture of how those areas have been affected by the infection. But for an individual who has a positive antibody test, well, what does that tell us? We don't really know yet whether having had the infection and having had antibodies present in your blood, what that means in terms of, are you immune now? And if you are immune, how long does that last? And even if you are immune, does that mean you might still transmit the virus to someone else? So really the advice at the moment, even if you've had a positive antibody test, the advice still is that you should try and maintain social distancing to follow all the advice that's available at the moment.
So for most people who aren't working in care homes or aren't working in hospitals, if they're having a coronavirus test, it's a test for the virus almost certainly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's likely to be a test for the virus. And at the moment, that test is available for people who've got symptoms, for people who live with someone who's got symptoms, or if you're going into hospital, for example, for a procedure, you might get asked to have a test just to make sure you don't have the virus and you're bringing it into the hospital.
And you'll be hearing more from Navjot next week. But for now, let's turn to shielding. Around 2.5 million people have been advised to stay at home because they're most at risk if they catch coronavirus. They're supposed to pretty much avoid any close human contact, even from loved ones. But things are about to change, or at least for some. Our resident GP, Margaret McCartney, is here to explain what's happening.
As you know, James, at the end of March, the government published advice about shielding for what they called the vulnerable groups, people that were extremely clinically vulnerable to COVID. And over time, there have been some changes to that. So in early June, from the 1st of June in England, shielded people were told that they could now go for exercise and meet people at a distance. But from the 6th of July, England have said that people can meet with up to six people outside with social distancing in place. That's the 2 metres distance between you and other people. And they've said that you no longer have to socially distance inside your house with other household members. And what's more, you can now form a support bubble with another household of either a single person or with a single person or a single parent. So that's either you as a shielded person or the other household. So quite a few changes.
Now, something we're becoming very familiar with. England's doing one thing, other bits of the UK doing something very different. Why is the difference and who's right?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, James, it is different. It's different in each of the four nations. So, for example, in Wales, the Chief Medical Officer for Wales has said that they should extend their shielding until mid-August, till the 16th of August. And in Scotland, they've said that the shielding length of time is expected to end on the 31st of July. But they have also said that their guidance about what people can do is a little bit different. They're saying that people can now meet with one other household outdoors in groups of up to eight people from home. So there are little differences. If you look at the commentary that each of the four nations has published, it seems to be that each government is making their own judgment on the basis of the scientific evidence brought to them. And I think that's the point. At the end of the day, these are political decisions that are being made on the basis of the scientific evidence that's brought to people. Science is science. It doesn't necessarily tell you what you must do. And these are always judgment calls at the end of the day.
And hopefully shielding is going to end at the end of July for England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, and then mid-August for Wales, isn't it?
Yeah. So what they've said is they're anticipating pausing from the 31st of July. And I think that's what's important here. People are dealing with uncertainty. We don't know what will happen to the statistics. We can make judgments on what we think is likely to happen, but we don't know yet. And at the end of the day, these are all judgment calls. There's going to be no such thing as no risk. It's going to be about higher risk or lower risk. The people within that shielded group are disparate. They're different. They've got different diseases, different illnesses, different risk factors that will have to be added in somehow. People themselves have got different attitudes to risk, and the shielded advice has only been advice. It's not been the law. So some people will be very risk adverse. Some people will not be so risk adverse. Some people will judge that their mental health, their physical health is such that they want to make some different changes from what other people might be. So no one's quite sure, I think, what the risk is going to be at that point. And I think that's right. I think that the government is correct to say that this is what we hope will happen, but we need to look at the data nearer the time.
Dr. Margaret McCartney. That's it for Inside Health. The producer was Fiona Hill. Next week, race, ethnicity and health during the pandemic.